actually say I find it the most grating one I ever experienced. In the end, Madison hammered away at Hamilton with 5 essays published under the name Helvidius. The first essay reflected the deep animosity that had sprung up between the Federalist collaborators. Several pieces with the signature of Pacificus were late published, which have been read with singular pleasure and applause by the foreigners and degenerate citizens among us, who hate our republican government and the French Revolution. Madison complained of a secret Anglomania behind the mask of neutrality. He flayed Hamilton as a monarchist for defending the neutrality proclamation. Such prerogatives, he said, were royal prerogatives in the British government and are accordingly treated as executive prerogatives by British commentators. In prose more pedestrian than Hamilton's, Madison brought the perspective of a strict constructionist to the neutrality issue. He wanted full authority over foreign policy to rest with Congress, not the president, except where the Constitution granted the chief executive specific powers. Madison was both edited and supplied with cabinet secrets by Jefferson, who seemed to have no reservations about abetting this assault on a presidential proclamation. The instigator of many articles against his own administration, Jefferson knew that they were upsetting Washington. He felt sympathy for the president, but also believed he was getting his just deserts. He wrote to Madison in June, "The president is not well. Little lingering fevers have been hanging about him for a week or 10 days, and have affected his looks most remarkably. He is also extremely affected by the attacks made and kept on him in the public papers. I think he feels those things more than any person I ever yet met with. I am extremely sorry to see them." Jefferson then indicated that Washington had brought the attacks on himself. "Naked, he would have been sanctimoniously reverenced, but enveloped in the rags of royalty, they can hardly be torn off without laceration." During that eventful summer of 1793, administration infighting grew increasingly cutthroat. On July 23rd, Washington held a cabinet meeting that took on a surreal atmosphere. The president wanted to ask for Genet's recall without offending France. This pushed Hamilton into an extended harangue on the crisis facing the government. He alluded to a faction that wanted to overthrow the government, and he said that to arrest its progress, the administration should publish the story of Genet's unseemly behavior. Otherwise, people would soon join the incendiaries. What made this dramatic scene so unreal was that the spiritual leader of that faction was sitting right there in the room, Thomas Jefferson. That summer, Jefferson found Hamilton both insupportable and inescapable. Besides his treasury job, Hamilton conducted a full-time career as an anonymous journalist. In late July, the American Daily Advertiser printed his piece called No Jacobin, the first of yet another 9 essays that issued from Hamilton's fluent pen over a 4-week period. He began by hurling a thunderbolt. "It is publicly rumored in this city that the Minister of the French Republic has threatened to appeal from the President of the United States to the people." The leak of this secret information about Genet's insolent disrespect toward Washington had a pronounced effect on public opinion. In coming weeks, Hamilton continued to lash out at Genet for meddling in domestic politics. What baseness, what prostitution in a citizen of this country to become the advocate of a pretension so pernicious, so unheard of, so detestable. On August 1st, Jefferson found himself trapped again in a cabinet meeting with Hamilton, the human word machine, who spontaneously spouted perfect speeches in every forum. The Treasury Secretary thundered on about the need to disclose the damaging correspondence with citizen Genet. From Jefferson's notes, we can see the highly theatrical manner that Hamilton assumed in Washington's small cabinet. Hamilton made a jury speech of 3/4 of an hour, a weary Jefferson told his journal, as inflammatory and declamatory as if he had been speaking to a jury. One senses the laconic Jefferson's perplexity in dealing with this inspired windbag. "Met again," Jefferson reported the next day. "Hamilton spoke again, 3/4 of an hour. Hamilton repeated charges made by the royal European powers that France wanted to export its revolution to other countries. Jefferson inwardly reviled Hamilton as a traitor to republican government. What a fatal stroke at the cause of liberty. Et tu, Brute," he wrote in his diary. At this point, Jefferson finally aired his own views. He predictably opposed public exposure of government dealings with Genet and also warned of the futility of cracking down on democratic societies that had sprung up since Genet's arrival. If the government suppressed these groups, Jefferson argued, people would join them merely to assert the right of voluntary associations. His point was well taken, but he had squandered his credibility with the president, as he was about to discover in peculiarly dramatic fashion. With heroic fortitude, Washington had tried to remain even-handed with Hamilton and Jefferson, but he could no longer tolerate this dissension in his cabinet. A sensitive man of pent-up passion, he also could not endure the vicious abuse he had taken in Freneau's National Gazette. In May, Washington had asked Jefferson to fire Freneau from his State Department job after the editor wrote that Washington had signed the Neutrality Proclamation because the Anglo-men threatened to cut off his head. Convinced that the National Gazette had saved the country from monarchy, Jefferson refused to comply with Washington's request. Now, in a cabinet session, Henry Knox happened to mention a tasteless satirical broadside called The Funeral Dirge of George Washington, in which Washington, like Louis XVI, was executed by guillotine. This libel was thought to have been written by Freneau. Knox's reference lit a fuse inside Washington, and the seemingly phlegmatic president became a powder keg. In his Annas, Jefferson described the unusual scene. The president was much inflamed, got into one of those passions when he cannot command himself, ran on much on the personal abuse which has been bestowed on him, defied any man on earth to produce one single act of his since he had been in the government which was not done on the purest motives, said that he had never repented but once the having slipped the moment of resigning his office, and that was every moment since, that by God he had rather be in his grave than in his present situation, that he had rather be on his farm than to be made emperor of the world, and yet they were charging him with wanting to be a king, that rascal Freneau sent him 3 of his papers every day, as if he thought he would become the distributor of his papers, that he could see in this nothing but an impudent design to insult him. He ended in this high tone. There was a pause, some difficulty in resuming our question. Jefferson scored few points in the cabinet that August. It was decided that America, as a neutral nation, could not allow belligerent powers to equip privateers in her ports or give them asylum. As head of the Customs Service, Hamilton was charged with punishing violators, fortifying his hand in foreign affairs. All the while, Jefferson conspired to strip Hamilton of his power. On August 11th, he sent a confidential letter to Madison, noting that Republican representation would be stronger in the new House. The time had therefore ripened for weakening Hamilton with 2 measures: splitting the Treasury Department between a Customs Service and a Bureau of Internal Taxes, and severing all ties between the Bank of the United States and the government. If Jefferson could not diminish the man, he would try to diminish the office. For all his growing dismay over the incorrigible Genet, Jefferson still blocked cabinet efforts to release the full saga of Genet's impertinent behavior. He threatened to resign in late September, telling Washington that he hated having to socialize in the circles of the wealthy aristocrats, the merchants connected closely with England, the new created paper fortunes, and he again cited steps being hatched to bring a monarchy to America. Jefferson agreed to stay until year's end only after Washington agreed to keep confidential Genet's obnoxious conduct. His cabinet colleagues continued to dissent. "Hamilton and Knox have pressed an appeal to the people with an eagerness I never before saw in them," Jefferson told Madison. Hamilton got the story out indirectly by prompting Senator Rufus King and Chief Justice John Jay to publish a revealing letter in a New York paper. An agitated Genet protested to Washington, asking him urgently to dissipate these dark calumnies. His letter's intemperate tone would only have strengthened the suspicions he sought to allay, and Jefferson consequently had to draft a letter to France on August 16th, asking for Genet's recall. Jefferson admitted that the tales told about Genet were not Federalist fabrications. "You will see much said and gainsaid about Genet's threat to appeal to the people," Jefferson told Madison. "I can assure you it is a fact." All through August, Madison and Monroe crafted resolutions thanking France for aiding the American Revolution. When Washington broke with Citizen Genet, a crestfallen Madison stated that it will give great pain to all those enlightened friends of the principles of liberty on which the American and French Revolution are founded. Nor would Philip Freneau concede that the French Revolution had taken a vicious turn. In early September, to stress parallels between the two revolutions, he printed in succession the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the American Constitution. The situation in Paris, however, soon undermined this thesis. That spring had seen the creation of the Committee of Public Safety, soon the principal vehicle of revolutionary terror. In June, the moderate Girondin faction, to which Genet belonged, was purged and placed under house arrest by radical Jacobins. This Jacobin triumph, Hamilton realized, had made French officials receptive to American requests to cashier the bumbling Genet, whom they accused of offending a friendly power. Led by Robespierre, the Jacobins swept aside all obstacles to their reign of terror. Nocturnal house searches and arbitrary arrests became routine by the fall. Priests were persecuted and churches vandalized in an anti-Christian campaign that led the Cathedral of Notre Dame to be renamed the Temple of Reason. On October 16th, Marie Antoinette, or the Widow Capet, as she was designated, was pulled from her cell, stuck in a tiny farm cart, paraded through streets teeming with heckling citizens, and beheaded. The guillotine worked overtime. 21 Girondins were executed on October 31st alone. As Hamilton got wind of the bloody fate that awaited Citizen Genet in Paris, he urged Washington to allow him to remain in the United States, lest Republicans accuse Washington of having sent the brash Frenchman to his death. Washington agreed to give him asylum, and Citizen Genet, ironically, became an American citizen. He married Cornelia Clinton, the daughter of Hamilton's nemesis, Governor George Clinton, and spent the remainder of his life in upstate New York. In the end, Washington never submitted to Hamilton's wish to publicize a detailed account of Genet's dealings with the administration. But Hamilton had gotten most of what he wanted in the Genet affair, including the dearest bonus of all, the exit of Thomas Jefferson from the cabinet by year's end. Chapter 24. A Disagreeable Trade. While Washington meditated the fate of Citizen Genet that August, Philadelphia was beset by a threat far more fearsome than the French minister appealing to the American people. Some residents who lived near the wharves began to sicken and die from a ghastly disease that shook the body with chills and severe muscular pain. The red-eyed victims belched up black vomit from bleeding stomachs, and their skins turned a hideous jaundiced color. The onset of the yellow fever epidemic, the worst to have befallen the young country thus far, has been traced to many sources. The disease had ravaged the West Indies that year, and an influx of refugees after the slave revolt in Santo Domingo may have introduced it to Philadelphia. A wet spring giving way to an uncommonly hot, dry summer may have helped to spread the disease. Sanitary conditions were atrocious in many parts of town, with residents dumping refuse into clogged, filthy gutters and drinking water from wells contaminated by outhouses. By late August, 20 people per day were expiring from the epidemic, which was to claim more than 4,000 lives, bringing government and commerce to a standstill. Coffin makers cried their wares in front of City Hall. People didn't understand that the disease was transmitted by mosquitoes, but knew it could be communicated by contact with victims. People stopped shaking hands and stuck to the middle of the street to avoid other pedestrians. Some people covered their noses with vinegar-dipped handkerchiefs, while others chewed garlic, releasing malodorous clouds that could be smelled several feet away. The safest course was to flee the city, and 20,000 people did just that, thinning the ranks of government employees. By early September, 6 clerks in Hamilton's Treasury Department and 7 in the Customs Service had the disease, as did 3 post office employees. The city's preeminent physician was the indomitable Dr. Benjamin Rush, a sprightly, pretty fellow, as John Adams described him, who scarcely slept during the pestilence, flitting bravely from house to house, treating rich and poor alike. This required intestinal fortitude as carts rumbled across the cobblestones, carrying piles of cadavers, and residents were loudly exhorted, "Bring out your dead!" Rush had warning signs posted outside affected houses. In treating yellow fever, Rush adopted an approach that now sounds barbaric. He bled and purged the victim, a process frightful to behold. He emptied the patient's bowels 4 or 5 times, using a gruesome mixture of potions and enemas before draining off 10 to 12 ounces of blood to lower the pulse. For good measure, he induced mild vomiting. This regimen was repeated 2 or 3 times daily. Rush was a man of exemplary courage, but it is questionable whether he saved lives or only hastened deaths by weakening the body's natural defenses. On September 5th, 1793, Hamilton contracted a violent case of yellow fever. He and Eliza repaired to their summer residence, a mansion called Fair Hill that lay 2.5 miles from town and was owned by Philadelphia merchant Joseph P. Norris. Their children were sequestered at an adjoining house. To calm them, Eliza would appear at a window and wave to them. Pretty soon, Eliza had the illness, and the children were evacuated to the Schuylers in Albany. In an astonishing storybook coincidence, Hamilton's boyhood friend from St. Croix, Edward Stevens, had turned up in Philadelphia and now attended to the couple. A prosperous, distinguished physician, Stevens had practiced in St. Croix for 10 years until his wife Eleonora had died the previous year. He then married a rich widow named Hester Amory and moved to Philadelphia. Having treated yellow fever victims in the islands, Stevens dissented from the American dogma of bloodletting and bowel purges, which he thought only debilitated patients. He argued for remedies that were cordial, stimulating, and tonic. To strengthen patients, Stevens administered stiff doses of quinine called Peruvian bark, as well as aged Madeira. He also submerged them in cold baths before giving them glasses of brandy topped with burned cinnamon. He sedated patients nightly with a tincture of opium, laudanum. To stop vomiting, patients quaffed an aromatic blend of chamomile flowers, oil of peppermint, and lavender spirits. When they learned of Hamilton's illness, George and Martha Washington sent sympathy notes and 6 bottles of vintage wine. With extreme concern, I receive the expression of your apprehensions that you are in the first stages of the prevailing fever, the president wrote to Hamilton. Quite different was the response of Thomas Jefferson, who wrote a misguided letter to Madison that accused Hamilton of cowardice, hypochondria, and fakery. His family think him in danger, and he puts himself so by his excessive alarm. He had been miserable several days before from a firm persuasion he should catch it. A man as timid as he is on the water, as timid on horseback, as timid in sickness, would be a phenomenon if his courage, of which he has the reputation in military occasions, were genuine. His friends, who have not seen him, suspect it is only an autumnal fever he has. At one stroke, Jefferson heaped heartless abuse on a sick man and inverted reality. Not only did Hamilton have yellow fever, but he had shown outstanding valor during the Revolution, while Jefferson, as Virginia governor, had cravenly fled into the woods before the advancing British troops. Edward Stevens achieved spectacular results with Alexander and Elizabeth Hamilton, curing them within 5 days. Trusting a man who may have been Alexander's biological brother, the Hamiltons were saved while countless others perished. Ever since King's College, Hamilton had been interested in medicine. He had had his children inoculated against smallpox. He was not content to be a passive patient. No sooner had Stevens cured him than Hamilton wanted to proselytize for his approach. With Eliza responding well to treatment, he published an open letter to the College of Physicians, hoping to stop that undue panic which is fast depopulating the city and suspending business both public and private. Praising Stevens, he said his friend would gladly relate his methods to the medical faculty. Hamilton's letter created a sensation. Even in illness, he was shadowed by controversy, since he had implicitly rebuked Benjamin Rush. Rush gave Stevens's methods a fair chance for several days, tossing buckets of cold water on patients and injecting quinine into their bowels, but he could not reproduce Stevens's results and reverted to the rigors of bleed and purge. Unfortunately, this legitimate clash of medical viewpoints took on political overtones. Rush was an abolitionist and a passionate, outspoken reformer who later published a groundbreaking treatise on mental illness. He was also a convinced partisan of Jefferson. So when Hamilton lauded Stevens's yellow fever treatment as superior to the standard method, Rush was perhaps predisposed to take offense. An unfortunate medical dispute erupted between the Republican method of Rush and the Federalist alternative of Stevens. Rush was not averse to casting the controversy in political terms. Colonel Hamilton's remedies are now as unpopular in our city as his funding system is in Virginia and North Carolina, he declared. He was persuaded that Hamilton's open letter betrayed political bias against him. I think it probable that if the new remedies had been introduced by any other person than a decided Democrat and a friend of Madison and Jefferson, they would have met with less opposition from Colonel Hamilton. Rush, like Jefferson, refused to believe that Hamilton had had yellow fever and pooh-poohed it as an overblown cold. Colonel Hamilton's letter has cost our city several hundred inhabitants, he told Elias Boudinot, asserting that the Hamiltons had suffered nothing but common remitting fevers from cold instead of the malignant contagion. Though Benjamin Rush blamed Alexander Hamilton for yellow fever deaths, the public ended up blaming Rush. After a second yellow fever epidemic in 1797 and more copious bloodletting, Rush lost so many patients that President Adams rescued him by appointing him treasurer of the U.S. Mint. Alexander and Eliza eagerly awaited a reunion with their children in Albany. To make sure they were fully recovered, they relaxed and took carriage rides for 2 or 3 days before leaving Philadelphia on September 15th. They set aside any garments that might have been infected and packed only fresh clothing. It was a long, wearisome trip. On the first leg, they stopped at a tavern packed with terrified refugees from Philadelphia who refused to allow the Hamiltons to enter until the landlord insisted upon it. At town after town, they had to contend with barriers erected to keep out potentially contagious Philadelphians. Even New York posted guards at entrances to the city to deter fugitives from the plague-ridden capital. The most unpleasant confrontation came in Albany. On September 21st, the Albany Common Council passed a resolution forbidding ferrymen from transporting across the Hudson people who came from places infected with yellow fever. Philip Schuyler had to negotiate the Hamiltons' arrival with Albany's mayor, Abraham Yates, Jr. On September 23rd, Alexander and Eliza were stranded at a village directly across the Hudson from Albany. A delegation of physicians crossed over, examined them, and pronounced them fit. Leaving their servants and carriage on the east bank, the Hamiltons then crossed the Hudson and settled at the Schuyler mansion as a hubbub arose over their arrival. One rumor said that after embracing Eliza, Philip Schuyler had swabbed his mouth with vinegar disinfectant and then washed his face and mouth as if she might still be contagious. Yates informed Schuyler of fears that the Hamilton carriage, baggage, servants, and clothing might transport yellow fever. He even wanted to station guards at the Schuyler mansion to avert contact between the Hamiltons and the local citizenry. Hamilton's political opponents must have enjoyed the symbolism of the Treasury Secretary spewing contamination wherever he went. An offended Schuyler told Mayor Yates that the Hamiltons had brought neither clothes nor servants across the river and had taken all reasonable precautions. He promised that his family would not venture into the city and asked that a guard bring food out to the mansion, for I am fully persuaded that it cannot be the intention of my fellow citizens that I and my family shall be exterminated by famine. Sarcastically, he suggested that the guard might want to deposit the food between the house and the main gate. Not until September 26th did Hamilton learn that his father-in-law had submitted to strict conditions to receive them. He then wrote in high dudgeon to Yates, insisting that he and Eliza had adhered to all safety measures and that it was absolutely inadmissible to cut off their access to town. Hamilton warned that he would go about his business, which force alone can interrupt. During the following days, he and Eliza replenished their strength with fresh air and exercise. They learned from Washington's secretary that reports of Hamilton's death in New England had produced deep regret and unfeigned sorrow, which had given way to marks of joy and satisfaction when the reports proved unfounded. The controversy over Hamilton's presence ended when the Albany Common Council passed a resolution opening the city to anyone in good health who had been absent from Philadelphia for at least 14 days. Having last been in Philadelphia more than 2 weeks earlier, the Hamiltons were free to move about. Both Washington at Mount Vernon and Hamilton in Albany itched to resume the suspended work of government. Oliver Wolcott, Jr., who headed the Treasury Department in Hamilton's absence, had retreated to a large house on the Schuylkill River, leaving 2 or 3 clerks to soldier on in otherwise empty downtown offices fumigated with brimstone. Washington contemplated cabinet meetings in Germantown or some other spot free of fever near Philadelphia, but was stumped by a constitutional conundrum. Did he have the power to change the seat of government temporarily? Washington turned to his oracle on such matters, telling Hamilton that as none can take a more comprehensive view and, I flatter myself, a less partial one on the subject than yourself, I pray you to dilate fully upon the several points here brought to your consideration. Hamilton was very good at circumventing such legal roadblocks. The Constitution, he told Washington, allowed Congress to meet elsewhere only for specific, extraordinary purposes, and a contagion wouldn't qualify. He solved the problem by a subtle semantic shift, saying that the president could recommend meeting elsewhere. And so, Hamilton recommended Germantown as the ideal place. Several Treasury clerks who had fled to New York for safety had ignored Wilcott's pleas to return to work. En route from Albany in mid-October, Hamilton collected these renegade employees. By October 26th, he and Eliza arrived at Robert Morris's estate on the Schuylkill, the Hills. They stayed there for several weeks as isolated cases of yellow fever lingered in pockets of Philadelphia. For the first 3 weeks of November, the cabinet met in Germantown until frost removed any danger of returning to downtown offices. For some time after their brush with yellow fever, the Hamiltons experienced pronounced after-effects. "Colonel Hamilton is indisposed and has sent to New York for Dr. Stevens," Benjamin Rush gloated on November 3rd. "He still defends bark and the cold bath in the yellow fever and reprobates my practice as obsolete in the West Indies." There were several days that November when the conscientious Hamilton skipped cabinet meetings and found his mind muddled, completely out of character for him. On December 11th, he sent a totally atypical note to Jefferson. "Mr. Hamilton presents his compliments to Mr. Jefferson. He has a confused recollection that there was something agreed upon with regard to prizes about which he was to write to the collectors, but which his state of health at the time put out of his recollection. If Mr. Jefferson recollect it, Mr. H. will thank him for information." In late December, Hamilton told Angelica Church that he had mostly conquered the malignant disease that had left him prostrate. "The last vestige of it has been a nervous derangement, but this has nearly yielded to regimen, a certain degree of exercise, and a resolution to overcome it." Among the casualties claimed by the yellow fever epidemic was John Todd, Jr., whose widow, Dolly Payne Todd, married James Madison the following year. Another victim was the National Gazette. The epidemic had cost the paper money, as had Freneau's rhapsodies about Citizen Genet. On October 11th, Freneau stepped down as State Department translator, and 2 weeks later announced the suspension of his paper. The following month, Hamilton and Rufus King took up a collection to assist his competitor, John Fenno, and his ailing Federalist paper, The Gazette of the United States. Hamilton abused his position as Treasury Secretary by appealing for help to Thomas Willing, President of the Bank of the United States, who could scarcely rebuff a request from Hamilton. It was a hypocritical lapse for a man who had so often chided Jefferson for exploiting his office to assist Freneau. It was perhaps fitting that the demise of the National Gazette preceded the year's most satisfying event for Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson's resignation as Secretary of State on December 31st, 1793. The Virginian had failed to eject Hamilton from the cabinet and had lost the contest for Washington's favor. For a long time, he had felt estranged from the cabinet and had labored under such agitation of mind as he had never known, he confided to his daughter. To Angelica Church, Jefferson groaned about the dreary scenes of business in Philadelphia and commented, "Never was any mortal more tired of these than I am." In returning to his beloved Monticello, he was to be liberated from the hated occupations of politics and sink into the bosom of my family, my farm, and my books. Jefferson proclaimed that he would now be a stranger to politics and would limit his statements to a single topic, the shameless corruption of a portion of Congress and their implicit devotion to the Treasury. Jefferson projected the image of a contemplative philosopher yearning for his mountain retreat, but the magnitude of his ambition was sharply debated. It irked John Adams that Republicans considered Jefferson's resignation to be the sign of a pure, self-effacing man. "Jefferson thinks by this step to get the reputation as an humble, modest, meek man, wholly without ambition or vanity. But if the prospect opens, the world will see and he will feel that he is as ambitious as Oliver Cromwell." He thought Jefferson's resignation a shrewd tactical move to position him better for a later run at the presidency. Following Jefferson's departure from Philadelphia, he wrote to Abigail, "Jefferson went off yesterday, and a good riddance of bad wear." Hamilton was no less convinced of Jefferson's hidden aspirations. In the spring of 1792, he had written, "'Tis evident beyond a question, from every movement that Mr. Jefferson aims with ardent desire at the presidential chair." When Hamilton's son John wrote his father's biography, he left out one story that is contained in his papers. The authenticity of the anecdote cannot be verified, but it jibes with other things Hamilton said. According to this story, soon after Jefferson announced his plans to step down, Washington and Hamilton were alone together when Jefferson passed by the window. Washington expressed regret at his departure, which he attributed to his desire to withdraw from public life and devote himself to literature and agriculture. Staring at Washington with a dubious smirk, Hamilton asked, "Do you believe, sir, that such is his only motive?" Washington saw that Hamilton was biting his tongue and urged him to speak. Hamilton explained that he had long entertained doubts about Jefferson's character, but as a colleague had restrained himself. Now he no longer felt bound by such scruples. Hamilton offered this prediction, as summarized by his son. From the very outset, Jefferson had been the instigation of all the abuse of the administration and of the president, that he was one of the most ambitious and intriguing men in the community, that retirement was not his motive, that he found himself from the state of affairs with France in a position in which he was compelled to assume a responsibility as to public measures which warred against the designs of his party, that for that cause he retired, that his intention was to wait events, then enter the field and run for the plate, that if future events did not prove the correctness of this view of his character, he, Hamilton, would forfeit all title to a knowledge of mankind. John C. Hamilton continued that in the late 1790s, Washington told Hamilton that "not a day has elapsed since my retirement from public life in which I have not thought of that conversation. Every event has proved the truth of your view of his character. You foretold what has happened with the spirit of prophecy." The story's likely veracity is bolstered by the fact that Jefferson exchanged no letters with Washington during the last 3.5 years of the general's life. For Hamilton, the triumph over Jefferson was a bittersweet victory that he scarcely had time to savor. He was besieged by enemies, worried about his health, and felt unappreciated by the public. In a letter to Angelica Church, Hamilton, nearly 39, struck again a world-weary note. "But how oddly are all things arranged in this sublunary scene. I am just where I do not wish to be. I know how I could be much happier, but circumstances enchain me." In another letter he said, "Believe me, I am heartily tired of my situation and wait only the opportunity of quitting it with honor and without decisive prejudice to the public affairs." The Republicans had captured majorities in the Congress that convened in December 1793, and that would render a final verdict over Hamilton's conduct as Treasury Secretary. He had already told Washington that he would stay in office only as long as it took to clear his name. In mid-December 1793, in a rare political spectacle, Hamilton asked House Speaker Muhlenberg to resume the Giles inquiry. While he had been exonerated by the first Giles investigation, the examination had been rushed by the short deadline, and Hamilton wanted to erase any last doubts about his probity. Whatever private melancholy he poured out to Angelica Church, he sounded buoyantly combative when he told Muhlenberg of the probe, "The more comprehensive it is, the more agreeable it will be to me." The Republicans were happy to oblige him. Even before Giles got down to business, Senator Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania submitted resolutions asking for a comprehensive account of Treasury operations. He demanded reams of paper from Hamilton, ranging from a full statement of foreign and domestic debt to an itemized list of revenues. This oppressive investigation was scrapped when the foreign-born Gallatin lost his Senate seat after charges were made that he had not met the 9-year citizenship requirement. Hamilton, meanwhile, chafed at the dilatory tactics of Giles, who did not revive the Treasury inquiry until late February, even as Hamilton made threatening noises that he would resign. Hamilton was being badgered from all sides. He was still deluged with questionable petitions, often marred by fraud or missing paperwork from people claiming compensation for services provided during the revolution. He felt so harassed by complaints of negligence from the Senate that on February 22nd he complained to Vice President Adams in an anguished letter. Hamilton alluded to burdensome petitions, the disruptions of the yellow fever epidemic, and eternal congressional studies of his conduct. As a conscientious public servant, he felt he should be spared petty censure over his handling of the petitions. "I will only add that the conscientiousness of devoting myself to the public service, to the utmost extent of my faculties, and to the injury of my health, is a tranquilizing consolation of which I cannot be deprived by any supposition to the contrary." 9 days later, Hamilton delivered to Congress his decisions on no fewer than 30 complex petitions for wartime compensation. On February 24th, the House assembled a select committee with sweeping powers to investigate the Treasury Department. Reflecting the new composition of Congress, the bulk of the committee was Republican. The members drew up an exhausting schedule to drain any energy Hamilton had left. Until their work was complete, they planned to meet every Tuesday and Thursday evening and Saturday morning. For 3 months, the committee stuck to this punitive schedule, and Hamilton testified at about half the sessions. Besides providing extensive official information, he had to disclose all of his private accounts with the Bank of the United States and the Bank of New York, as Republicans tried to prove that Hamilton had exploited his office to extort credits from the two banks. The Select Committee, finding it hard to fix blame on Hamilton, fell back on the one charge that Giles had made stick, that he had exercised too much discretion in shifting government funds between the United States and Europe. When the committee asked Hamilton to cite his authority for transferring money abroad to the Bank of the United States, he cited both verbal authority and a letter from the president. The committee, suspecting a bluff, demanded proof, and Hamilton asked Washington for a letter to back up his assertions. Washington obliged Hamilton with a mealy-mouthed letter that was so bland. "From my general recollection of the course of proceedings, I do not doubt that it was substantially as you have stated it, as to undercut Hamilton's position." His enemies guffawed. The letter from the president is inexpressibly mortifying to his, Hamilton's, friends, Madison wrote to Jefferson, and marks his situation to be precisely what you always described it to be. As delicately as possible, a crestfallen Hamilton advised Washington that his letter might seem a lukewarm endorsement to cynics. He worried that false and insidious men would use it to infuse doubts and distrusts very injurious to me. In fact, Washington was beginning to balk at Hamilton's requests to transfer money in ways not tightly tied to specific legislative acts. Whether he thought the Jeffersonian arguments had merit or merely popular backing, Washington subtly distanced himself from Hamilton, insisting that he segregate funds from different sources. Once again, he proved that he was not a rubber stamp for Hamilton's policies. At the same time, he hardly wished to repudiate his Treasury Secretary and promised to help out with Congress. In the end, the Select Committee found no wrongdoing in the way Hamilton had used European loans for domestic purposes. In its final report in late May, the Republican-dominated committee could not deliver the comeuppance it had craved. Instead, it confessed that all the charges lodged against Hamilton were completely baseless, as the Treasury Secretary had insisted all along. And what of the endless Jeffersonian insinuations that Hamilton had used public office to extract private credits? The report concluded that it appears that the Secretary of the Treasury never has, either directly or indirectly, for himself or any other person, procured any discount or credit from either of the said banks, Bank of New York and Bank of the United States, upon the basis of any public monies which, at any time, have been deposited therein under his direction. The vindication was so resounding that Hamilton withdrew his long-standing resignation, and his cabinet position grew more impregnable than ever. Nevertheless, it frustrated him that after this exhaustive investigation, his opponents still rehashed the stale charges of misconduct. He had learned a lesson about propaganda in politics and mused wearily that no character, however upright, is a match for constantly reiterated attacks, however false. If a charge was made often enough, people assumed in the end that a person so often accused cannot be entirely innocent. Once again, the best clue to Hamilton's mood comes from his confiding letters to Angelica Church, who still felt trapped in England by her husband's position in Parliament. In one letter, Hamilton offered Church a whimsical but rueful meditation on the nature of public office. This previously overlooked letter is contained in the papers of Hamilton's son James, who tore off and crossed out other portions, making one wonder whether it contained evidence of the long-rumored affair between Hamilton and his sister-in-law. Hamilton observed, "Truly, this trade of a statesman is but a sorry thing. It plagues a man more than enough, and when it obliges him to sacrifice his own pleasure, it is very far from fitting him the better to please other people. I speak from experience. You will ask why I do not quit this disagreeable trade. How can I? What is to become of my fame and glory? How will the world go on without me? I am sometimes told very gravely it could not, and one ought not, you know, to be very difficult of faith about what is much to our advantage. Besides, you would lose the pleasure of speaking of your brother-in-law as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, if I am to give up the trade. There is no fear that the minister will spoil the man. I find by experience that the man is every day getting the upper hand of the minister." Chapter 25. Seas of Blood. After Jefferson left the cabinet, Washington did not conduct a purge of Republicans. On the contrary, the unity-minded president turned to the foremost congressional Republican, James Madison, as his first choice as Secretary of State. Only when Madison rejected the job did Washington hand it to Attorney General Edmund Randolph, who was succeeded in his post by William Bradford of Philadelphia. This sequence of events did not stop Jefferson and Madison from complaining that Washington was a captive of crafty, manipulative Federalists. Jefferson's presence lingered in Congress through Madison. On the eve of his departure, Jefferson submitted a bulky report to the House on European trade policies toward America. He laid out a litany of charges, from unfair dominance of transatlantic shipping to the banning of American boats from the British West Indies, to buttress his claim that England discriminated against American trade. Based on this evidence, Jefferson advocated commercial reprisals against Britain, coupled, not surprisingly, with expanded trade relations with France. On January 3, 1794, Madison introduced 7 congressional resolutions that converted Jefferson's brief into a tough anti-British trade policy. 10 days later, Federalist William Lawton Smith rebutted him in an eloquent speech of 15,000 words that adroitly picked apart Madison's arguments. Smith suggested that it would be suicidal for America to disrupt relations with a country that accounted for most of its trade. As soon as Jefferson scanned Smith's speech, he knew his old bête noire had struck again. "I am at no loss to ascribe Smith's speech to its true father," he told Madison. "Every letter of it is Hamilton's, except the introduction." Jefferson had guessed shrewdly. Hamilton either drafted Smith's speech or provided the information. Responding to Madison's attempts to solidify relations with France, Hamilton lashed back in his time-tested manner. Under the disguise of Americanus, he published 2 fervid newspaper essays about the horrors of the French Revolution. He condemned apologists for the horrid and disgusting scenes being enacted in France, and branded Marat and Robespierre assassins still reeking with the blood of murdered fellow citizens. Long before Napoleon came on the scene, he predicted that after wading through seas of blood, France may find herself at length the slave of some victorious Caesar. Unfortunately for Hamilton, even as he touted England as a law-abiding ally, the British evinced a bullying arrogance and stupidity toward America that surpassed the most acrid Jeffersonian caricatures. England refused to acknowledge the traditional doctrine, "free ships make free goods," that is, that neutral vessels had a right to carry all cargo save munitions and enter the ports of belligerent countries. On November 6, 1793, William Pitt's ministry had decreed that British ships could intercept neutral vessels hauling produce to or from the French West Indies. Without further ado, the British fleet captured more than 250 American merchant ships, impounding more than half of them as war prizes. Britain also boarded American vessels at sea and dragged off sailors, claiming they were British seamen who had deserted. These high-handed actions kicked up such a ruckus in America that for the first time since the Revolution, the prospect of a new war against Great Britain seemed a genuine possibility. The Federalists felt shocked betrayed, and embittered. The English are absolute madmen, sputtered an indignant Fisher Ames. Order in this country is endangered by their hostility no less than by French friendship. When Hamilton heard about British depredations, he did not behave like a pawn of British interests. Rather, he drew up for Washington contingency plans to raise a 20,000-man army to defend coastal cities and impose a partial trade embargo. The pains taken to preserve peace, he told Washington, include a proportional responsibility that equal pains be taken to be prepared for war. Once again, Hamilton and Washington agreed that the executive branch should take the lead in a national emergency. While continuing to meet with his dogged congressional investigators, the sorely taxed Treasury Secretary instructed customs collectors to fortify ports for a possible invasion, while Federalists presented plans to Congress for a provisional army. As word spread that the omnipresent Hamilton might supervise this new force, Republicans discerned another insidious power play. You will understand the game behind the curtain too well not to perceive the old trick of turning every contingency into a resource for accumulating force in the government, Madison told Jefferson. Madison and other Republicans opposed Federalist plans to form an army and increase taxes for national defense. When Federalists suggested that it was high time America had its own navy to combat the plunder of American shipping by Barbary pirates, Madison suggested, in all seriousness, that the United States hire the Portuguese navy instead. Bent upon postponing war with Britain, influential Federalists gathered at the lodgings of Senator Rufus King. They agreed that Washington should send a special envoy to England and proposed Hamilton, who thought he was a splendid choice. As usual, the mere mention of his name sent Federalists into shivers of ecstasy. "Who but Hamilton would perfectly satisfy all our wishes?" asked Ames. At first, Washington leaned toward Hamilton and grew resentful when Edmund Randolph interposed objections. Randolph thought Hamilton had been too vocal in criticizing France to enjoy credibility as an objective negotiator with Britain. Republicans joined this chorus of dissent and talked as if Washington were about to deputize the devil himself. Representative John Nicholas, brother-in-law of Senator James Monroe, told the president, apropos of Hamilton, that more than half of America have determined it to be unsafe to trust power in the hands of this person. Did it never occur to you that the divisions of America might be ended by the sacrifice of this one man? Jefferson detected yet another cabal to place the aristocracy of this country under the patronage of the British government, not to mention a convenient way to send Hamilton abroad and protect him from the disgrace and public execrations which sooner or later must fall on the man. In the end, Washington concluded that Hamilton lacked the general confidence of the country and wisely opted for a less partisan figure. On April 14th, Hamilton composed a long, plaintive letter to Washington and removed himself from consideration for the post. Madison said that Hamilton was crushed and informed Jefferson that he had been turned down to his great mortification. Yet Hamilton must have known he would be a divisive choice. He also had reasons for staying close to home. He feared that without him, Washington might submit to Republican influence. He was still committed to vindicating his reputation before the Congressional Investigating Committee, and he wanted to deal with ominous protests now gathering force in western Pennsylvania against the excise tax he had imposed on liquor. In his letter to Washington, Hamilton made some statements on foreign policy of lasting significance, especially the idea of war as a last resort. He said that he belonged to the camp that wanted to preserve peace at all costs, consistent with national honor, resorting to war only if attempts at reparations failed. He warned that Republicans wanted to poison relations with Britain, foster amity with France, and cancel debts owed to England. The British would then retaliate by blocking commodity exports to America, causing a catastrophic drop in customs duties. This would bring the Treasury to an absolute stoppage of payment, an event which would cut up credit by the roots. Hamilton has often been extolled as the exponent of a rational foreign policy based on cool calculations of national self-interest. But his April 14th letter expressed his unswerving conviction that nations, transported by strong emotion, often miscalculate their interests. Wars oftener proceed from angry and perverse passions than from cool calculations of interest. War with Britain might unleash violent popular fantasies and set in motion turbulent passions that would lead to extremism on the French model, pushing America to the threshold of disorganization and anarchy. Like so many Hamilton polemics, the letter was a hot-blooded defense of a cool-eyed policy. When he took himself out of the running for envoy, Hamilton recommended John Jay as the perfect substitute. The only man in whose qualifications for success there would be thorough confidence, and him whom alone it would be advisable to send. As the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Jay lacked Hamilton's conspicuous liabilities as a party head. Hamilton had always admired Jay, but with reservations. He once said of Jay that he was a man of profound sagacity and pure integrity, yet he was of a suspicious temper. In contrast to Hamilton's colorful exuberance, Jay often dressed in black, tended to be taciturn, and could be aloof, though Philip Schuyler once said that he numbered Jay among the few men for whom he had an affection approaching love. Jay consented to undertake the mission to England without resigning as Chief Justice. Republicans found him more palatable than Hamilton, but far from a neutral choice. In their eyes, he was another Federalist smitten with England. Nevertheless, the Senate approved him. To offset Jay's appointment, Washington decided to choose a Republican to succeed Governor Morris as American minister to France and settled on James Monroe. Aaron Burr and some Republican colleagues suspected that Hamilton had induced Washington to veto Burr. For Burr, this was another of many times that Hamilton spiked his aspirations for office. But Washington continued to distrust Burr as a devious, prodigal man and needed no prodding from Hamilton. If Hamilton could not go to London, he would engage in freelance diplomacy at home. Even before Jay was confirmed by the Senate, Hamilton met twice with the imperious George Hammond, Britain's minister to the United States. Once again, those who saw Hamilton as toadying to Britain would have been surprised by how vehemently he laced into Hammond. Hammond told superiors back in London that the Treasury Secretary entered into a pretty copious recital of the injuries which the commerce of this country had suffered from British cruisers, and into a defense of the consequent claim which the American citizens had on their government to vindicate their rights. Hamilton wanted compensation for American vessels captured in the British West Indies, and Hammond was taken aback by the degree of heat Hamilton showed. At a meeting with Jay and Federalist senators, and in a follow-up memo prepared for Washington, Hamilton sketched out Jay's instructions as envoy, making him the primary architect of the treaty that was to result. In addition to compensation, Hamilton wanted a settlement of outstanding issues from the 1783 peace treaty. The most controversial item on his agenda, however, was the forging of a new commercial alliance in which each nation would receive most favored nation status from the other. That is, the lowest possible duties on goods they traded with each other. Presumably, this would increase the volume of trade between the two countries. After some modification, Hamilton's instructions were adopted by the cabinet as Jay's marching orders. In frequent meetings with Jay before his departure, Hamilton made clear that he did not want to coddle the British. On the contrary, because of the outrage voiced by the American people, Hamilton wanted Jay to be tough and demand substantial indemnification. At the same time, he wanted Jay to woo the British with a compelling vision of the advantages of closer Anglo-American ties. On May 12th, 1,000 New Yorkers cheered from the docks as Jay sailed to England, hoping to avert war. Notwithstanding Republican fears, Washington and Hamilton treaded the fine line of neutrality that summer. The U.S. government protested renewed attempts by French privateers to seek asylum in American ports while building up American military strength in case of war with Britain. Washington gave orders to construct 6 frigates, the birth of the U.S. Navy, and Hamilton negotiated contracts for many naval components, cannons, shot and shells, iron ballast, sailcloth, live oak and cedar, and saltpeter for gunpowder. Republicans watched Jay's mission with grave doubts. Madison had a nagging intuition that Jay would surrender too much to England and rupture Franco-American relations. The Republican press clung to the malicious fantasy that Jay would negotiate the sale of America back to the British monarchy. There were fresh rumors to boot that Hamilton was involved in a nefarious plot to make the Duke of Kent, the 4th son of King George III, the new King of the United States. This prompted one Republican wag to opine that the royal family should adopt Alexander Hamilton to sire a new line in America. With Hamilton's well-known attraction to the ladies, the British monarchy would need never worry about a shortage of heirs in America. Even as the repression in France acquired a terrible new ferocity, Republicans could not shed their warm, fraternal attachment to the French Revolution. However upset by gory deeds committed in the name of liberty, Madison was heartened when Joseph Fouché, Citizen Genet's successor as French minister, declared the revolution firm as a rock. Jefferson still gazed at France through rose-colored glasses that magically transformed horrific events into a fresco of glowing colors. "I am convinced they will triumph completely," he said in May 1794, and blamed the excesses not on the French, but on invading tyrants who had dared to embroil them in such wickedness. Far from being repelled by bloodshed, Jefferson awaited the day when kings, nobles, and priests would be packed off to scaffolds which they have been so long deluging with blood. By early summer 1794, that blood ran in rivers, and executions in Paris reached a monstrous toll of nearly 800 per month. Nevertheless, when Jefferson's protégé James Monroe arrived in France, he embraced the president of the National Assembly and, to Jay's dismay, lauded the heroic valor of French troops. Where Jefferson dismissed these wholesale killings as regrettable but necessary sacrifices to freedom, Hamilton was traumatized by them. The burgeoning atheism of the French Revolution reawakened in him religious feelings that had lain dormant since King's College days. "The very existence of a deity has been questioned and in some instances denied," he wrote in alarm about French attacks on Christianity. "The duty of piety has been ridiculed, the perishable nature of man asserted, and his hopes bounded to the short span of his earthly state. Death has been proclaimed an eternal sleep." For Hamilton, the French Revolution had become a compendium of heretical doctrines, including the notion that morality could exist without religion, or that human nature could be so refined by revolution that government itself will become useless and society will subsist and flourish free from its shackles. Hamilton somehow managed to be worldly without having seen the world. He kept abreast of occurrences in France by subscribing to French newspapers and periodicals, and he polished his French through a Philadelphia tutor, Monsieur Donat. Equally important, he obtained eyewitness accounts of the French Revolution from the exodus of largely aristocratic refugees who flocked to America. At its peak, this refugee flood was so huge that one in every 10 Philadelphians was French. One exile christened the capital the French Noah's Ark. Hamilton felt at home among these elegant, reform-minded aristocrats. Mr. Hamilton spoke French fluently and, as we did not sympathize with the revolutionists who drove the exiles from their homes, he was a favorite with many of the cultivated émigrés, Eliza recalled. He was small, with an extremely composed bearing, unusually small eyes, and something a little furtive in his glance, Moreau de Saint-Méry said of Hamilton. He spoke French, but quite incorrectly. He had a great deal of ready wit, kept a close watch over himself, and was extremely brave. Nobody else ever faulted Hamilton's French. Another émigré, Madame de la Tour du Pin, said of Hamilton, "Although he had never been in Europe, he spoke our language like a Frenchman." Many French aristocrats were directed to Hamilton by Angelica Church, who had entertained them at her bountiful London table. She steered to him the Vicomte de Noailles, Lafayette's brother-in-law, who had formed part of the Brotherhood at Yorktown and knew Hamilton well. Like other refugees, de Noailles had been hopeful at the inception of the French Revolution, then recoiled in horror as it veered toward violence. Church also referred the Duc de la Rochefoucauld Liancourt to Hamilton. An enlightened aristocrat and social reformer who had set up a model farm and two factories, the melancholy Duke had tried to protect the king from mobs in 1792 before seeking safety in England. In Philadelphia, he grew to adore Hamilton. "Mr. Hamilton is one of the finest men in America, at least of those I have seen," he later wrote. "He has breadth of mind and even genuine clearness in his ideas, facility in their expression, information on all points, cheerfulness, excellence of character, and much amiability." Whatever is carping about the French, Hamilton invariably managed to charm them. Most French refugees were in desperate straits, having suffered steep declines in status and wealth. Once well-to-do Frenchmen now scraped out livings by giving French lessons, becoming cooks, or opening small stores. I wish I was a Croesus, Hamilton told Angelica Church. I might then afford solid consolations to these children of adversity, and how delightful it would be to do so. But now, sympathy, kind words, and occasionally a dinner are all I can contribute. Both Alexandra and Eliza Hamilton had a special feeling for the dispossessed, and helped to raise money for indigent French emigres. Beginning in 1790,